What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Nick Sanza. Right out of high school, Nick Sanza entered the U.S. Army 2nd and 15th Infantry, 3rd Division, working in teletype and in decoding crypto. He served during the Cold War in the Berlin Border Patrol at the East and West German border and 3 other tours of duty. Nick's family had 4 generations in the U.S. Army. His grandfather rode in the Rough Riders during the Spanish-American War. His father is the last driver for General George Patton from the beaches of Normandy to the outskirts of Berlin during World War II. We definitely discuss that in great detail. And he has some amazing stories to tell. And his son was a sniper in Special Forces during the Iraq and Afghanistan conflicts and gave his life for his country. During Vietnam, he was what was known as a tunnel rat, which we go into in great detail as well. And some incredible stories there too. After serving in Vietnam, Nick decided to try his hand in Hollywood. Nick is known in the entertainment industry as Napa Nick. He started in the film and television industry with the television series Falcon Crest, which aired on CBS, as a second unit production manager, location scout, and script development. During his time with Falcon Crest from 1982 to 1989, he was also a stuntman and a stunt coordinator for Francis Coppola Productions, Paramount Studios, Castle Rock Productions, NBC, CBS, Universal Television Productions, and Dick Wolf Productions. In 1992, Barbara Walters, working for ABC, hired Nick as a production and location manager to set up a television special for ABC's 2020 spotlighting Julia Roberts, who was at the time filming in the Napa Valley in a feature film called Dying Young. 2 months after the special aired, Nick was hired as a producer and investigative journalist for ABC's Good Morning America. But occasionally he produces for Primetime, World News, Nightline, and the Academy Awards, which he did for 3 years. It was such a pleasure talking with him. Some incredible stories, as I've mentioned. And I think I'll just leave it there and turn you right over to Nick Sanza. Okay, I'm here with Nick Sanza. Nick, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
You bet, Josh.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. There's so much I want to speak with you about. I want to talk about Vietnam. I want to talk about your quite literal war stories. And I want to talk about your time in the movie business as well. But before we do all that, Nick, could you please tell our listeners a little bit about briefly sort of who you are and what you do?
Again, my name is Nick Sanza Sr. I started out when I was younger. I played semi-pro ball football with the Raiders, their little farm team they had. And after that, I got into the movie business by a friend who called me and said, you know, they're looking for a location manager to do this TV show, Falcon Crest. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't want to get in that business. I like my football. Well, I spent some time with the location manager, and then I set them all up and got everything done. What they thought would take 2 weeks, I did in 3 days.
Wow.
So locations were set up that they wanted. And not long after that, I got a call from the executive producer, and he said, you want a job? You want to get into business? And I said, nah. He said, just try it for a couple of days. Well, I did it for a couple of days, and I said goodbye to football. It was all gone. And the reason I did that, too, is that how I got called upon to do Falcon Crest is that the producer on Falcon Crest was Barbara Walters' husband at that time. And I did 3 shows with Barbara, and she was, as you know, she passed away.
Yes.
She was a sweetheart. She treated me like gold, and I love that lady. And she's the one that got me into Hollywood, got me into Falcon Crest. But Hollywood was really weird. In 92, Good Morning America called me and asked me to work for them as an investigating journalist and a producer because I was in the military. So I did the military stuff for them. But all of a sudden, it became a full-time job. And I enjoyed it. And I still worked in Hollywood, but doing Falcon Crest, that's the one that got me going. And when I went into Hollywood, I started working on major movies, major televisions. I was a stuntman for almost 9 years. Also on top of that, I just wanted to do it all. So basically, that's what I did. And I retired in 2013. The reason I had to do that is because my wife had metastatic cancer and I was her caregiver for 6 years. So I took care of her and I didn't go back to Hollywood. But sometimes ABC has called me and said, could you, would you? You know, and it depends on what the story is. Then I've got another partner who used to be at Paramount. We're now doing our own shows now for our World War II veterans. And we're going to go into our Vietnam veterans now for the cable networks. So that's where I'm heading now.
Oh, fantastic, Nick. Thank you. And we'll scale that ground a little bit deeper later on in the interview.
Okay.
So, Nick, you come from a family that sent four generations of men to fight in foreign wars. And I'd love for you to take as much time as you really need to, Nick. I'd love to hear about your heritage of service.
For my family? Well, it started with my grandpa. He was a horseman to begin with, and he was in the Spanish-American War. And they were looking for horsemen, so they took my grandpa. And they made him he took care of the horses for Teddy Roosevelt's group, the Rough Riders. Well, he became a Rough Rider, and that's where he did his job in the military. But he was a horseman. I mean, he was like your mechanic on the Jeeps. He was a mechanic on the horses, shoes, feeding, doing everything, and make sure everything was done. But he also fought in Spanish-American War. And then my dad was General Patton's right-hand man in World War II. He did a lot for Patton. He built specialty Jeeps for him. The kind of Jeeps he built were for snipers. In other words, my dad had that thing pretty well set up. They went into the old graveyard of the airplanes and took out the old bulletproof windows and everything and made that Jeep and made it all. I think I sent you the picture.
Yes.
And then you see all those windows are from the airplanes. He designed the whole thing. And then he put in a Mercedes-Benz seat to make him comfortable because Patton wanted something comfortable. That's what he gave him. So, I mean, him and Patton were sold together mostly all through Europe. He picked my dad up in late 1942 to get everything ready for Europe. And I mean, they went through a lot of stuff that you would not believe. And what you hear in the history books and stuff can't even come close to what my dad told me. And I mean, I've got what my dad told me was unbelievable what those two did. And I'll say, too, because of Patton, we may not have won the war. I mean, he didn't take it, as you know, he didn't take it of anybody. He knew things right. had to be done and he did it. In fact, people don't know this. They offered him that job as the command general of the whole war, not Ike. He said, give it to Ike. He's the prima donna. He can do that. I want to fight. I don't want to sit behind a chair and say, well, can we do this? Can we do that? And Pop said he was a good man to him. He took care of my dad. And my dad was the only one that knew that I went to Vietnam because we had codes. Him and I had our own codes. He used code 52 in there. So when he did that for codes, when he sent stuff in, they knew where he was with Patton. Well, I turned that number around and made it 25. So they knew where I was when I went to 25. So I used my dad's code, you know. So it's kind of, we kind of kept it in the, you know, nobody knew but my dad and I. And he is the only one that knew where I went. And we never talked about it. And I told him I couldn't talk about it for 45 years.
Wow.
Now, my son was a sniper in Iraq and Bakuba. And in the Panama down there where the drugs and everything were. And he gave his life for his country, but he took out almost close to 200 guys. And that was his job. And he had only one spotter. And he was very well. He was, to all my kids, I made him go through martial arts. And he was my martial arts man. He was a professional boxer for Don King. He also was a kick fighter, martial arts kick fighter. And that's why he went in the service. And they asked him, we need you. So he went in to keep the tradition going. Of course, you know my background. You know,
yes.
Vietnam, the tunnel rat. And then also in Germany, I was on the Berlin Wall a little bit, but mostly in Poland and mostly in a place called Weilflicken. And I was a cryptologist. And of course, I was on the line at all times.
Yeah.
And that's basically my routine. Now I'm retired and just kind of enjoying life and building military sets at the museums in California.
That's fantastic, Nick. Thank you. You know, so the name of my show here that we're on is called Eyewitness History. And boy, I'm chopping at the bit here, Nick, in the interest of sort of preserving oral history, right? That great tradition. I'm curious if there's a story that your father told you about General Patton that people might not know. Would you feel comfortable sharing?
I can give you one about Buchenwald.
Sure.
Buchenwald is where we took where Ike and Bradley, you know, Ike and Bradley were sewn together. And, you know, Ike had to talk to Bradley. To Bradley to talk to Patton because Patton wouldn't talk to Ike. So we'll put it that way. A little bit of a forte there because, well, it's Miss Military, but they had taken over a town called Buchenwald. And my dad, Patton called my dad up. He said, look, he says, we got a lot of Jewish guys. And there was Jewish, of course, you know, were mostly prisoners. And they were half dead there. And Patton went to my dad and he says, look, I just found out there's a small camp about 5 minutes away from here, but Buchenwald, I need you to go check it. Take the captain and two guards with you and go check it out and see what's in there. So they got it. Got the Jeep, took off, went up north a little bit. And up there was a camp for Jewish kids. These kids were half dead. And just, he said, he was, you know. And then what happened is the guards, everybody left. But there was two guys that were left there that were like, they said they were burgermeisters, but they weren't really burgermeisters, you know, in Germany. They were actually, here's how it goes. They were actually SS troopers. They were Hitler's right-hand men. that ran that camp. But they covered themselves and made them look like they were, because they couldn't get out of there in time. Oof. Well, my dad went back and told Patton. So Patton got in the Jeep. Some more guys went up there and saw these kids. I mean, they were just skin and bones. Dad, and made my dad throw up. He said, I got sick, what they looked like. But he brought one of the kids back to the camp to show Patton what they looked like. And Patton was, you know, went back up to the place above Buchenwald. And they went to the office where those two SOFOR, what they called, they were Burgermeisters. Well, the guy made a mistake. He actually picked his arm up and there was the SS mark on his arm. And my dad caught it and Patton called it. Before my dad could pull his pistol out, my dad had his hand on the pistol. And my dad told me, he says, look, you have to go downtown and bring people in. We got to get these kids taken care of. And the two guys that were the SS said, we can't do that. And then all of a sudden, that's when they saw the arm bed. Before my dad could pull his gun out, Patton pulled out and shot him both in the head. Took him out right there. The third guy was crying. He said, I'll tell you what you want. I'll tell you whatever you want. I'll tell you. That's what happened. Ever since then, that's the one thing that really hit Patton. That's why he never stopped after that. When he saw that, my dad saw it. That was it. Montgomery, get out of the way because I'm taking your job. If you don't do it, get the hell out of my way. And that's what they were, because Montgomery and Patton never got along.
Right.
And no offense to the English, but he was not a general. I studied this man. He was not a general. He was, whenever I'll get there, I'll get there. And that's the way they were. Patton says, I'm going now. Patton went 190 days straight in battle. Straight in battle. Yeah. And that's it. My dad was right there with him all the way through it. He said, many times I heard a click, click in the back of my seat because he put a metal bar. Snipers were trying to kill my dad to get the Patton. You know, and he knew he was a target. And that's why and he developed the bulletproof and everything on that Jeep.
That is extraordinary.
We've got the original Jeep too that my dad had. We got it in our museum.
That's incredible.
Belgium. Yeah.
That's extraordinary, Nick. Thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate it. I would really love to hear a story of your father saving his life if you're up for telling me.
With Patton, they were in that one town outside of Schweinfurt, and there was a sniper that was trying to get Patton. Nobody knows about this, really. Even Bradley, anybody didn't know about it, because my dad and him would take off and go scouting on the front lines. Just them two would go out scouting to see where they're going to take the next battle and where he's going to position his men. Well, what happened was they found this one sniper kept, I guess they followed him. I have no idea, but dad was telling me they followed him. And one time that dad happened to see the guy in the building and he pushed Patton forward and it just ricocheted my dad's chin. It would have hit Patton in the head, because Patton had the door open and my dad chewed him out. My dad chewed Patton out. He said, you shut that door from that one on. Yeah. You know, and it just missed my dad. And he said that's the one time that after that, Patton listened to my dad, because my dad had a vision like I did. I could see everything. Patton's vision was, I want to get to that war. I want to get this done. I want to get it done now. Let's do it. And my dad was the same way he was, but more cautious in many ways, you know. But Patton was a very strong, strong man. I mean, this guy, he could see things before it happens, Pop said. He had that vision to where he could see before anything happens, and he knew how to go at it. He would always beat Montgomery. Anywhere Montgomery went, he was there ahead of him. He said, I took the shortcut. You're going to have your tea and go sit down for a while. That's what he told him. You know, I mean, him and Patton and Montgomery never got along, because Montgomery always knew to walk softly around Patton, because he knew he'd beat him everywhere he was supposed to be. Patton beat him there. Patton was supposed to be his backup. Patton goes, I don't do that. He told Ike that. He told Truman that. Okay. Tell Truman, his dad, he says, Jeep. Patton gave my dad the name Jeep because he built a special Jeep for Patton. So that's all the name because he couldn't say his name either Soldier or Jeep. So he built everything for Patton. And he just told, I mean, he told my dad, he says, I trust you with everything in the world you have, because he did. I mean, they were together 90% of the time, you know. And he said, I'm going to give you things to do. I know you'll have it done. And then you'll tell the captains, because they know when you come to them, it's Patton's word. So they got to do what you say. You know, and these were colonels and captains, and they did what my dad said, you know. But my dad was good with him. He wasn't cocky. But Patton, that one time that he started listening to my dad about the snipers, because that's why my dad built that special case, that special beam behind, and even back behind his Mercedes seat, it was metal. So they tried to catch him from behind when we passed him. And you hear tink, 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 tink. They were shooting at him. And dad said, we got to get out of here. My dad used that as a signal, knowing that they got to get out of the position to where they can hit us. Because when they hit that metal, well, they didn't know what there was in the metal because it looked like a seat. But he knew that. But Pop saved Patton four or five different times. And Patton treated my dad like he was a brother to him. Wow. When he sent my dad home in November of 45, and then when Patton got hit, remember when he got, you know, he was in the accident in the Jeep and the truck? Well, that was a plan. That was a setup. the guys that shot him, killed. They were, in other words, I'll say it, Truman ordered, we know what Truman did. They wanted Patton out because Patton wanted to go and take care of Russia. He wanted to go all the way in. And it, a lot of the guys did, because if we did take care of Russia, there'd be no communist country. And they made a major mistake during World War II by not doing that. And even a lot of the colonels and captains and generals said the same thing. They made a mistake. They should have let him go, because we'd have taken him out, he said, in 20, 30 days, it'd been all over with. Because we had all of our equipment there. We were there in Berlin. We were right there.
Right.
But Patton was a strong man. The man had no fear. No fear at all. Nothing at all. And neither did my dad. Because where they went, you know, a lot of the colonels rode with my dad, and they said, I'm not riding with Patton. He's going to get us killed. Nobody would ride with him, with my dad and him. Yeah. But yeah, he saved him quite a bit. I'd say Pop said, I think it was about 5 times. And that one time when he told him, he says, you know, you got to be careful, because what they're going to do is they're going to kill me to get to you. And if they get to you, it's over with, you know. And my dad still says, my dad knew, which is not even in the books, not even Eisenhower, not even Truman, not even Roosevelt. They didn't know what Patton knew. Because he kept it to himself, and my dad and Captain Stiller and the other two colonels. They won that war. I don't give a damn what anybody says. They won that war. And he said, and then they asked my dad and Patton, he said, would you like to go to Japan? He says, no, I lost enough men. He said, let McCarthy take care of it. He's doing a pretty good job. I don't need to be there. Then they sent him back. And then he took over, like, you know, like the governor of Germany and everything for a while. And then they said, we have to attack Russia. We got to go after him. And then that's what happened when the truck hit him, but he was hit in the back of the head with a sniper gun, because my dad knew everything.
Yeah.
He knew what happened. And they called my dad in. They brought him. After my dad went home, the government, U.S. Army, called him back and had him in for questioning, you know. And knowing my dad like me, he just told him like it was. He says, you killed him. That's what my dad told him. He said, wait, that's enough. He said, we're not going to interview anymore, because they knew he knew. And they sent him back home.
Wow.
I'm like my dad. I tell you, I'm not going to lie to you. I'll tell you like it is. You don't like it. Hey, there's the front door. We do what we have to do, and we get it done. If not, goodbye. You know. And they said, oh, he lost a lot of soldiers. He saved a lot of soldiers. Because for Patton, they had lost twice, 3 times that. You know. So that's basically what it is. Yeah. And that's what Pop was. I mean, like I said, he didn't want his medals. He didn't care, because he didn't do it for that. He could give a damn. And that's the way I was. You keep the medals, trash them. I don't want those damn things. Yeah. I don't care what they are.
It's incredible.
And our POWs, when I want to say one thing, our POWs, yes, should have gotten the Medal of Honor, every single one of them. They didn't. That was wrong. You know, that was wrong.
Yeah. So, yes, let's get into Vietnam, Nick. Take all the time you need for this one. But tell me about your service at Vietnam. When did you enlist, and what was the experience?
Well, here's what happened. I had a scholarship for Notre Dame. It was there waiting for me. All I had to do was get the papers filled out and send to it. But then when they called the draft, my number was 7. And I thought, oh, that's it. That's not going to happen. I'm going. But I didn't know where I was going. But I made sure that I knew where I was going by going in and enlisting, because I wanted to spend, this was in May of 71. I wanted to spend the summertime with my buddies, because I mean, I had a lot of friends. We were very close buddies. And so I went in and enlisted. So I had to report August 19th of 1971 to Fort Ord. So, you know, I got in, my dad took me to the bus stop in Napa. And he picks up in the bus and he says, you know, keep your mouth shut, do what you're supposed to do. Don't volunteer for anything. Just do your damn job. Well, that time I didn't know, because I already signed the form saying, what would you like to do in the military and all this and that? And I'm thinking, oh, what a knucklehead. They've already got it. I'm done. No. So when I filled in there, you know, I said I wanted to be a DI agent. That's what I was going to school for, because Notre Dame taught that. Notre Dame was also a veterans in a military school in many ways. And that's why I wanted that. And so when they said, well, this is where you're going to Fort Ord and we got you for Germany, I said, yeah, all right. But the reason I did that, because my dad said, when you'll have time, I want you to go where I went. So he gave me everywhere he went. So I was able to travel to see. Oh, wow. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I wanted. And I'll say it again. That's what I wanted to do. But when I got to Germany, there was before they were going to send me to Waldfecken, to my camp, there was a DIA agent there. I didn't know who he was. He was a warrant officer. At that time, warrant officers were DIA agents. Defense Intelligence Agency is what they were. And he said, Mr. Stanzi, get in. I'm taking you to your camp. I'm thinking, okay, who are you? He says, none of your business. Just get in the Jeep. I said, yes, sir. I went in. I went to my camp, got everything set up, and they said, and then I went on, and the captain said, you're going to school. You're going to be going to a teletype cryptograph. I was a cryptographer also. And they got me to school to sign me in up above Schweinfurt. And the guy in the Jeep said, I'm taking you there. And I said, yes, sir. And he says, when you go up there, sign in and get your butt back here right now, don't talk to nobody. You get in this Jeep right now. I said, yes, sir. And I said, why? He said, that's none of your business. Just get in the Jeep. And so when I'm signing in and came in the Jeep, All that training I did at Fort Ord for 16 weeks for Vietnam and for Tunnel Rat was only one guy trained me. He was a Filipino, and his dad was the built tunnels for the Japanese in the Philippines. And this guy was a tunnel rat, but he was called a sapper, which was just to go in and blow up and get out and get out of the tunnels. We never knew our names. We could never say our names because what we did was very high clearance. And then the weekends when I was in basic and AIT, I trained for tunnel rat. I didn't quite understand what it was, but then I thought, oh, this is cool because going in tunnels, because when I was on my grandma's ranch when I was a kid, I used to dig holes in the tunnels and go back 10 feet and build a fort in there. It never bothered me. But when they got me in there, and when I got into the first day of training, I'll just make a quick synopsis so I'm not going through all of it. They got me into training and there was 20 of us and they told me what we were going to do. And not even the captain of my basic training knew where I was. They were told just to back off and leave this man alone. That's what they did. So we got the first day of training and there was 20 of us they picked to do it. And the second day they said, okay, I need you guys to go in this tunnel. Okay. They want to see if we could do it without, you know, being scared and all that, you know, just, you know, in the dark, you know, there was no light. So I was the last one to do it because I was the shortest, actually. I was the last one. I was only 5'1", weighed about 130 pounds. And I did it. You know, and the guys came out and they couldn't do it. They went in 10 feet and came out. One came out crying. It scared the hell out of them. Well, by the time they were talking, I went 100 yards. I was on the other side waiting for the DI to come and get me. They were looking for me. I was sitting on the other side waiting for them. I went through the whole tunnel with no problem. I mean, I'm not saying I'm good, but I had no fear. And I didn't get scared because, of course, I was in martial arts. I was in Kachikipo Karate and Tai Chi Kwan. So structure mind-wise, I was there, and it didn't bother me. So after that, he says, okay, good. Well, you're going to fit what we need. I'm thinking, well, who the hell are you? He says, you'll see. You're going to fit our needs. So when I found out, they started training me. And I'm thinking, oh, God, here we go. So after my training was done, the 16 weeks during even basic, I did basic, and then on the weekends, I did the training for Vietnam. I mean, I literally was beat up, but I didn't quit. I was in really good shape. I was in good physical shape. If it wasn't for that, there's no way I could have finished it. But after I went through all the 16 weeks of AIT and basic for Vietnam, their training, the DIA guy was there, which was a warrant, obviously. Okay, come on, you're coming with me. And I think, okay. I got to Germany. They set me up in my headquarters in Wielflicken, which was called Wildflicken. I mean, it was one of the main places for alerts for Germany. And we were isolated. I was in isolation. It was an isolation up in the hills in the Bavarian. Well, he took me back. And the captain said, you're going to go to training in Schweinfurt. So I caught the train. But when I got out to the train in Wildflicken, that DI agent was waiting there for me, the warrant officer. He says, get in the Jeep. You're going with me. And I said, who are you? That's like I said. And he said, this is who I am. I said, okay, fine. He says, we're going to take you to Schweinfurt. When you get up in there, you go up to the building, you sign in to Schweinfurt, sign your name and get the hell back here and get back in this Jeep. Don't talk to anybody or say anything. Just sign in. So I did. I got in the Jeep and I was really confused. And I said, what the hell's going on? He said, it's time. I said, time for what? He said, all the training you did at Fort Ord, you're going to do it now. I said, where are we going? He said, well, we're going to fly into Udorn, Thailand, is where a lot of us flew in before we went into Vietnam. And he says, you're going to Vietnam to be a tunnel rat. And I said, oh, I said, now when I thought about it, I thought, it's over for me. I thought, oh, God, I'm done. This is done. I kind of knew what to expect, but not all that. Well, that's how I got into Vietnam. And then my first tunnel, you know, with the DIA agents, I had 3 DIA agents and 2 Hmong. The Hmong were the CIA agents' army. And these guys were freaking good. I mean, these guys knew everything, but they would not go in a tunnel. So Knucklehead here is the one that had to go in a tunnel to find everybody, you know. And the 2 Hmong really had my back. They were our recon. And they knew exactly where everything was because at that time, on May 7th of 1972, Nixon was going to get us out of Vietnam.
Yes.
He was going to Paris talks to talk to them, okay. Well, I had to be done by May 6th to get everything to them so the DIA can tell them what's going on, okay. And they wanted to know where everybody was. Okay, because only 590 came home. And I had 1,200 on my list. Wow. If you saw the picture I sent, you saw that book on my side. That was my list because you saw the radio on my back.
Oh, yes. I had
that. Okay, that was my code list. Well, after that, you know, I found out. And I said, okay, fine. I got a job there. Let's just get it done. So we flew into Laos. And my first one I went into was just between the Laos and Cambodia border. And they told me what I was looking for. So when I went down there, you know, the first time I went down, there was 2 guys. Actually, there was 3, but there's 2 guys. They had stuffed our POWs and killed them and left them there because they didn't want them to know that they couldn't make it to Hanoi, so they killed them. So they just, in the United States, just put them as MIAs. They weren't there. But a couple only had dog tags because they took all the dog tags. And, I mean, they were skin and bones. I mean, just like a bone. And I saw them in there, and their eyes were wide open. And it was really weird. I thought, what the shit am I doing here? And I just sat there and looked, and I thought, okay, these guys never told me this. I never was trained for this. I came out of that hole. I had my .38 revolver in my hand and with the silencer on it. And I pointed it right at DI agents. And one guy said, you did a good job. We just wanted to see if you can do it. And so I pointed the gun at him. I said, now I can do it. Now you're going to tell me what I'm looking for. If you don't, I'm going to shoot you right here. And they knew I meant it. And my little two recon among, they kind of just backed away and left me alone because they knew I was. Ever since then, they sat me down. This is what you're going after. And again, I thought, oh, I'm done. This is over with, you know. And I said, how many guys made it? He said, none. He said, you're last of the four. I said, what happened to three? They died the second day. And I'm thinking, oh, God, thanks for telling me that. It just, but I don't get scared. And fear is what teaches you what's going to happen. Scare teaches you you're going to die because you're going to run scared out of there. You're going to be crying. You're going to out of there and you're done. But I got it to where in time to where fear, I got it to where in my mind where fear feared me. Screw you guys. I don't give a shit. What do I got to do? Let's get it done because those are my buddies down there. And I found 31 in all the tunnels between Laos, Cambodia, North and South Vietnam. And some of the stuff like, I mean, the one that hit me really hard was up in Phu Bai, which is up north towards the border, heading up towards Dai Du, where the Marines got really hit in 68 in the Tet Offense. I was up north up there. And when I went in there and I got in there, you know, and we were looking for one prisoner that was up there. And then Phu Bai is where they have the rice paddies, the dikes. There's a lot of dikes up in Phu Bai and they're pretty well built. On the other side, they had tunnels where they hit our guys. And these, like I said, these Hmong, these guys were good. They knew everything. And he said, we know there's some down there. And I said, okay, then that's my job to go down. But these two were the last ones we had to find. And they were in the jungle outside of Phu Bai. Okay. And so we went into the jungle and I found the tunnel. I thought, oh, this is not a bad one. I can fit in this because those things were like 3x2 or 4x3. And sometimes I could stand up in it. Not all the way because those Viet Cong guys, those were like 4'9 and 4'8. These guys were small. And that's the ones that used it. Well, I was pretty lucky because I was short. But when I got in there, on that one up there, I was hiding up against the wall and my Hmong guys were looking around because sometimes they would stuff them in the bushes in the jungle and hide them. You couldn't see them because the jungle was so thick. So I got pretty well down, not too far in. And all of a sudden this door opened up the tunnel. There was a hatch on top and I thought, oh, they're coming in. So I had to back up and I got back and I saw this head sticking its way in. I didn't realize who it was at first. I didn't know who it was. So I grabbed him by the hair and I took out my knife, the Japanese knife. That thing was probably about 3 to 4 inches long. It was a big knife. And I was ready to stab it in his throat to pull him down. But I saw a tag on him. And I said, I know that tag. That was one of my Hmong guys saying they found the guys. They were trying to catch him before I went way into the tunnel. And I scared the hell out of him. I'm telling you real truth. I would have killed him because I was taught to put it through their throats. Then they can't talk. They can't say anything. They're done. You know, you hit their larynx, you hit the esophagus. It's all done. So after I did that, I mean, I felt really bad. And they said, we found the guy. So I got out of there right away and they showed him and they were tucked in the tunnel. I mean, they're tucked in the bushes in there and you couldn't even see them. I mean, they were so badly eaten up from the animals and everything else, they found him. And then the little guy, I mean, I scared the hell out of him because he knew he was done. And we learned that day not to do that to me because if I see anybody, I don't know, I'm taking you out, you know? So he was, at that day, from that day on, he was like a shadow to me. Everything. What do you need? What do you need? I got. That was his famous word. I got. What do you need? What do you need? I do what you say. I said, okay. Then we became friends, but I didn't get their names. We couldn't talk our names. So I was a corporal. They just call me corporal. But I had a black uniform on. We looked like, I hate to say that, but that's what they were. We looked like all of us were dressed in black. And the Hmong, they looked like the North Vietnamese in a hat. So they'd go into the villages. Nobody knew who in the hell they were. They'd come out and get me the report. I'm thinking, good, let's go do it. You know, so it was a different story. And then, I mean, I went through, like I said, 28 tunnels, but that was one of the hardest ones where I almost killed my own buddy. At that time, I don't care. You come through that hole, I mean, give my friend, I mean, to swear, but your ass is mine. And that's basically what it was. And I lost that day after I saw those guys. I mean, I lost the word fear. I didn't give a anymore. I had a job to do and nothing bothered me after that. And they knew, and the DI agents knew it. And the two Hmong knew, just let the man do his job. Leave him alone. Give me what I need and I'm gone. You know, don't touch me. Don't walk behind me. You know, just stay on the side so I can see who you are. You know, and in the jungle, it's pretty hard to do. But like I said, I went through 28 tunnels and found 31 dead. All of them were dead. They stuffed them in there because they couldn't make it to Hanoi. So they had to hide them. And I went far back as 400 yards and 60 feet down. And some of these, I found hospitals, makeshift hospitals. I found so a lot of them were abandoned because we were slowly pulling out of Vietnam at that time in 72. But we were still quite a few of us there. But that's why they were trying to make the deal. If they bring all of our prisoners to Hanoi by May 6th, May 7th, Nixon's going to come over and Paris talks, which yeah. never happened until a year later. Okay. But the job that I did matter. And it did. And what they did took that information, knowing that there has to be more, but they didn't do any more from what I heard on after that. But the stuff that I found on tunnels was just unbelievable. And I had to blow up too, because I was in one village above Dokto, in the middle of Vietnam and Dokto. And in that village, there are mostly guys and ladies, but they were calm. They were all, I knew they were. And under their village, I went in the village and they had RPOWs, and I know they stuffed them in there. I was so pissed. One of my little guys, I said, give me the C4 pack. Just give me the pack, because I learned how to use C4. I could blow up anything. I learned how to do it. And I can bring a building straight right now. I can take a building and pull it straight down if I wanted to. But that village, it was just them and the Kong ran there. And I said, I'm going to bury our guys. So I went down in the tunnel. I went down about, maybe 15, 20 feet down. And I laid out the claymore. And C4. I laid it up, got myself out of there, cut the fuse. I blew the whole town and they went down with it. And I buried our guys. Wow. But that's, you know, and they knew it. I took them all out. I said, on that, you know, that's my boys, you know. So, and they knew that, but then we got the hell out of there because there was no other village around us. We were heading back up, heading back down, coming into Coochie. And Coochie was the main area where a lot we build our camps over Coochie. They didn't know it at first, you know, and they kept popping up and killing our guys, you know. So I was in northern Coochie and I found four in there. Four of our guys were stuffed, but I couldn't take them out. I couldn't do with it. They were dead. And if they had dog tags, I took them. And in fact, there was three, not two. There was three that I'm surprised they had their dog tags. And then on the walls, they would put, a lot of those guys would put, I had a code in that book. That code would say, we were here, we're heading to Hanoi. We knew who they were. The code in that book was their names that they gave, the design on the walls. And I gave them to the DI agents, you know, and they took care of it. What that stuff went, I have no idea. My idea was to find them. Either if they're alive, get them out of there. If not, I couldn't touch them. But everyone that I found was dead. Wow. Everyone that I found there was dead. And that's through all the tunnels that I went through. And like I said, I was in Laos, Cambodia, North and South Vietnam. I was in the southern northern part of Vietnam where they were stuffing them up. I hate to say that, but that's what they were doing. They were stuffing them in the holes. They drag them back 20 yards and leave them there. Because like I said, sometimes I went as far as 400 yards. I was in there for one day sitting, waiting, because they knew they were coming. Our DIA guys knew they were coming, but we didn't know where.
That's extraordinary, Nick.
It's something you don't forget, you know, and it's something I still don't forget. And, you know, you deal with it.
You simply have to. There's no way around it, I suppose, huh?
Oh, no. And I was a 19-year-old when I came out of them freaking holes and headed back to Germany. I was a 40-year-old. I took shit from nobody, not even from the captain. When I was in the track for the captain, because I had the command track and the coding, and nobody's in that track but me because of my high clearance. And the captain sometime would get in and I'd say, sir, you can't come in. I said, I got to come in. I pulled out my gun. I said, you want to die? Get out of my track. We backed out. I couldn't because the clearance, he can't, those stuff he can't know. And that's where we were trained. And they knew after that. I mean, I didn't do it for respect, but they knew, let the man do his job.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I drove for the colonel and the captain.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
One thing I'm very interested to talk with you about, Nick, and I think you hinted at a little bit in your last answer here. I'm curious of the mindset when you're tunneling, right? And I'm curious about what you're seeing, what you're smelling, what it's like to be in the tunnel, knowing there could be quite literally anything on the other side. Could you maybe go in, obviously we talked about the lack of fear. Could you maybe go into some of the I suppose, psychological preparation you have to have before going into one of these tunnels?
Here's what I did. And the first time I did it, one of the DIA agents, I sat down and took a knee and pointed my finger up to the sky. I'm a Catholic, and pointed my finger up to the sky. And he says, what do you do? And I said, it's none of your business. Just leave me alone. Go away. So I looked at that and I said, listen here, God, you better save me because you don't want me up there. If I come up there and you don't save me, your is mine. And that was my prayer. And I went down. And that day on, those DIA agents said, leave the man alone. Let him do what he's doing. He knows what he's doing. That's the kind of, and with our camaraderie, we were tight. After we lost one up in Fubai, but we were very tight and we knew how to track each other. But it's the fear. Here's what I was taught in training. I was taught to hear with my eyes and see with my ears, which is real. You go in that tunnel, it's dark. You got to see with your ears. If you can't hear anything, you got to, you know, it goes back and forth. And that's what I was. And I still say that all the time. Even when I taught my kids when they were young, I said, you want to hear with your eyes and see with your ears, because your ears can tell you more than your eyes can. And that's the way I was in the tunnels, because it was dark. So I could hear click. I could hear anything. I mean, I ran into snakes. I ran into scorpions, but I just took them away and got out of the way. But going in the tunnels, we were taught, because a lot of the tunnels had through, and you got down there, you drop down about 4 or 5 feet and you go in. There was all usually about 3 different tunnels. Some were dry, some were wet. I never took the wet one because that's the one they can drown you in, because they would flood it if they knew you were there. The dry one and the hard one is the ones they use. The ones that was half and half, still, that's for more traps. You want to go where they're not. And that's what saved my life. And I had a real good trainer. He's the one that trained me. The little things like that trained me. And like I said, I spent a day and a half, really, one. I said, I waited because I knew where they're going to bring them, and they knew it. And I said, well, I guess this is where I sleep. And for the almost 8 weeks, I never took a bath. I always rubbed mud, leaves, and everything on me before I went in the tunnel, because them guys could smell you. And really? I never ate any other food but their food. And I ate fish all the time, and I won't even touch fish anymore. When I came home, I said, I'd never touch fish again. It just made me sick. But I had to be them, because those guys could smell you and hear you and see you, you know. And I came close a couple of times. I still don't know how I'm here, but I came very close. But it wasn't for the training, knowing after the second week, I could feel the tunnels. I could feel it. And some of the guys that are watching this, when they see it, that were called sappers and tunnel rats, they were just told to go down in there. And that's why our tunnel rat rating was 3%. That's how lucky they were. 3% was that was it.
And just, I apologize to jump in, but just for our audience, when you say the tunnel rat was 3%, what does that mean exactly?
In other words, their life expectancy was 3%.
Ah.
That's what it was. And it was. There was no joke. A lot of them came out crying, couldn't take it. And I don't blame the guys.
Yeah.
But I was lucky for what I did when I was a kid. It stuck in my mind. This is fun. This is freaking fun. And that's what I thought. You know, and martial arts made me think, keep my body, keep everything out, especially Tai Chi Quan. Okay. That taught me a lot. Because when I was young, everybody kept picking on me. When I was in seventh grade, I got tired of it. The biggest guy picking on me, I took him down. He became my best buddy. He was my bodyguard. I mean, you know, that's just, you know, and I never used it.
Yeah.
I've never really had, and thank God, knock on wood, I never had to use it, because right. I could really hurt somebody. And I did over there. I took out, like I said, I took out over 60, and some were by hand. Most of it was by knife and hand, because I had to be very quiet.
You know, Nick, I've had the honor of interviewing a lot of veterans that served in Iraq, Vietnam, World War II. Yeah. I like to think I've developed a bit of a radar for what questions not to ask, right?
Ask whatever you want.
Would that be okay?
Oh, hell yeah.
Well, because I'm extremely curious to know what your closest call might have been.
The closest call was when we were up in, what was that little town called? Hue, H-U-E. We were up there because I had to meet the Marines to get my next orders and stuff, because I would meet them. They were meeting us there to get my stuff I needed. And Hue was the one where I thought I was done. I mean, I thought it was over with. Because when I got in there, I got inside the tunnel. I went down about 5 feet down. And then I went in, I'd say probably about 100 yards. And I kept hearing something. That's what attracted me to go to it. And I followed the path, which I was lucky. Because if I'd taken the other one, I'd have been dead in a second, because they had a trap set up. And I had my bamboo pole, which I should have brought. I apologize. I kept that pole. I brought it home, that I could hear the snap and I knew where the traps were. See, wow. This little Filipino guy taught me well. This guy was good. And I owe that guy my life. But that's where it really, when I got in there, I thought, oh, I'm not getting out of here, because I can hear a bunch of them. I'm thinking, I'm done. There's no freaking way I'm going to get it, because they're going to come the same path I am, and I have no way out. And it was mostly, I'd say 80% dark, but I could still hear and see a little bit of the light. I was following the light. So I'd hug against the wall. I only had that tunnel up and away was probably, I would say, 3 feet by 3, if I'm lucky. And I was crawling. And sometimes I crawl on my back because I didn't know what their spiders or traps above me, because that's where they hung the snakes. Those green viper snakes would kill you when they bit you. 5 seconds later, you're dead. And I used to take a lot of them out, but I crawled a lot on my back, and then I crawled on the side. And then all of a sudden I saw them, and I thought, oh, I'm done. This, I'm over with. There's no way I'm going to get out of here in time. Well, when those guys, I don't know what happened, but something got called. I don't know what it was. And they darted out of there. They darted out. I'm thinking, oh, there is a God. The old man's watching my back. So I went in there, and that's when I found a lot of stuff that we needed for details for the DI agents. But when I got in there, there was one guy sitting in the corner. He didn't see me. I still walked in very quietly. So I had my 38 with my silencer on it. And he got up. He was no more than 4 feet in front of me. I just took him out. I mean, I'll just tell you, I shot him in the head. I took him out. And I dragged him, tucked him under where they wouldn't know where he was. I grabbed some of the stuff that they had. They had a lot of maps and stuff. And that's what was in there, all their maps. And they had some of our own, our PRC radios. And all they had a lot of our stuff in there. And our grenades were in there. So what I did was, it was all set up. So they were gone. So what I did was, I thought, you know, I've got to destroy this. This is what sappers did. They went in and destroyed. They were engineers. They were taught in Australia, but I was taught in the States. So I went in, I had the guys give me some C4, and I just blew that whole son of a bitch up and sunk the whole thing, and we got out of there. But that's the one that I thought, I'm not going to make it home. So I might as well just do my job and just stay here, because they're going to surround it. They're going to surround it. But something called them, and they were freaking gone. But that one guy stayed in there. That one little guy stayed in there, you know, and I had to be very careful. You know, I didn't know. I could see, I mean, the room was probably, I'd say, maybe 10 by 10, maybe. They had cots in there, and they had all the maps and little things on there. And I thought, you know, this is their headquarters. I'm done. Just do your job. If you go, you know, you go. You know, you're not, you know, that's just the way it is. But when I took them out, and that was, I thought, damn, I'm out of here. But I grabbed what I could, and I was gone. And then when I got back, whatever I gave them, I didn't know what it was. I didn't care. I just did my job. And I said, what's next? You know, I said, that's not my job. That's your freaking job.
Right.
You know.
That's incredible.
And that's any of the tunnel rats that are watching this, and the sappers, they know what I'm talking about. A lot of them are just, the colonels would say, or captains on the, would say, okay, go down and see what you got. Just go down and see. They never were trained. I felt sorry for those guys, because a lot of them didn't make it out, because they didn't know what the hell to look for. And they were wearing gas masks, you know, because they had gas. You can't wear a gas mask. I never wore one, because you can't freaking see. A lot of them wore them when they went down. I'm thinking, God damn it. Why didn't they train these guys? But they didn't. And I had never wore a gas mask. I was all in black. I had my 38 silencer, and I had my Japanese bandit with me. And I had a small, I still have my little camera, a little small, you know, like the, you know, I Spies, those guys like, you know, they do, Roger Moore did, you know.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah. But they would take, every time I came out of a tunnel, they'd take the film out and put new, I didn't even touch it. They touched it for me, and everything was done. And then, but that was the one that really, I thought, I'm dead. I'm freaking gone. It's over with. But then after that, when we went up into North Vietnam, I was really pissed. I could give who was in front of me. I'd take him out. I don't give a damn.
That's extraordinary, Nick. Yeah. You know, I heard you make mention of it a few times already, so I'm tempted to ask you, what role faith played in your survival?
You mean being a religion? Faith?
Yeah.
You're talking about?
Yep.
Well, you know, I'm a Catholic. I was a Catholic, and very, very, I was pure Catholic. And because my dad was, my family came from Italy, you know, they were immigrants, and it was a Catholic family house, and I grew up that way. And in fact, I became an altar boy in the army because I didn't get a chance to do it and when I was home. So I became an altar boy. That was later when I was in Germany. That's a long story. But yeah, the religion played a big part of mine, because I had my cross that my dad gave me, because my dad was the only one that knew I was going. Nobody in the family knew. But my dad, because I talked to my dad about what he did when I went to service him. And my code was his code. Okay. And then he knew what I wrote letters. But I wrote him a letter after I came back so he wouldn't worry about when I was going.
Yeah.
So when I got back into Germany, he got my letter May 6th, you know, and everything when I was home. But I don't know. You know, I still think about that stuff. I mean, I have my nightmares. And two things that I get from there is, you don't want to scare me. You don't want to come behind me and scare, because I'll swing. I still have the habit of swinging. And noises, you know, sometimes in 4th of July, my kids used to get a kick out of it. They say, okay, Dad, here's your mattress. Firecrackers are going off. You can land on that. I would hit the ground. The first time I hit the ground, it was a July 4th party we had at my friend's house. And I was just turned 21 before I got married. And then they were laid off, and I was on the ground. And the guy looked at us and said, what the hell are you doing? I said, don't even ask me. Don't do that behind my back again. And he goes, oh, that's right, you in the military. And I said, yeah. I said, I appreciate that, guys. But I got to where I can handle all that stuff. You know, it's taken me a while. The VA, let me tell you something. Our VA is fantastic. Mm-hmm. They are taking care of us like it was, you wouldn't believe. They called me to get my butt in there. They said, you get in here. You can talk now. You get in here. Because I couldn't talk until after 217. The only one that knew what I did was my dad. And he passed away at 218 at 99. So, I mean, that's how we worked it. And it's just, I mean, the old man upstairs, it was a deal in our family. And dad did the same thing he did. But that after a while, when the guys knew I did it, they knew to leave Corporal Sands. I mean, I was a private at that time. To leave Private Sands alone, just let him do his thing. They knew to walk away and leave me alone.
Yeah.
And after they knew, I said, you know, you don't want me up there. And then they said, okay, time, work, let's go.
Good stuff. So it kind of blew past me a little bit earlier, but I'd love to maybe hear some stories regarding being a cryptographer. What's that like? And what was the experience like?
A cryptologist was teletype. And I had a high rating on that. I had high clearance on that. And I would follow the Russians. When we had Border Patrol, I had to send everything back into headquarters. And even I did it in Vietnam, too. Because I learned that when I was in basic training. The guys taught me that in basic training because I had to know that. Because they knew where I was going. And I didn't know over. They knew where I was going. But I had no idea I was going to that.
Right.
No idea at all. But here's the one thing, though, is that when the warrant officer picked me up and I asked him, I said, why the hell did you guys choose me? We said, well, we checked the records of your family because we knew your dad was Patton's right-hand man. And he saved Patton's life many times and he had no fear. He said, if you can do as half as job as your dad is, you'll come home alive. I said, well, sheet three, thanks for telling me that. I appreciate that. You know, so, I mean, they worked a lot off Patton and my grandpa.
Sure.
You know, this is what they did. I'm thinking, okay, you guys got me. Now, what the hell is my job? When I got there, I'm going, thanks, Dad. I appreciate it. But, you know, for 45 years, I couldn't talk. So I played football. I played semi-pro football. And all of our coaches were from the Raiders. It was really weird. They were Raider coaches, Raider team players and coaches, Ike Lassiter, Hugh Dixon, Charlie Smith, Art Shell, all of them were there. They were teaching us, you know. And we'd go scrimmage the Raiders all the time. Our teams would scrimmage them. But they found out that I was only 5'7", and I weighed 165 pounds. And I was really solid still. And so what they had me do is they had me, because we could take guys out on the knees. There was no ruling at that. So they had me taking guys out on knees so our guys can blitz. So I was taking them out on the knees, and I had no fear of these big guys. They were, who the hell cared? I just took their out, and that was it. And then I was a punt returner, too, and a kickoff returner. And then I lasted 2 years because my back and my knees, because I got injured in Vietnam and everything. And when I was in Bavarian, I went down 60 feet down a cliff carrying our radios for the coach to go back for the Russians war.
You know? Wow.
But I got myself back in shape. I wanted to play ball. I don't give a shit if it hurt. I played ball. I didn't give a damn, you know. And I had no fear of anybody. So every time I felt the helmet on my hand, Hugh Dixon and Charlie Smith says, okay, you got to take that number 77 out. He's not letting our guys get in there and blitz. He's your man. I take him out in the knees. And the guy'd get up and he says, damn, you little how'd you do that? And we had only one bar mask. We didn't have these full. We had the one bar mask, you know. I broke my nose twice playing. And so I just bandaged and went back to work, you know. Just back at it. No fear.
So then what did you do in the military after the war ended?
When Vietnam ended?
Yes, sir.
I went back to Germany. My main tour was Germany. That was my main tour. I went over there for school. And then that's where they picked me up, took me over in March of 1971. And then they brought me back there because that was set up by Colonel Bill McCaffrey, who's now passed away, who's the one that gave me my rings, gave me everything. And so I'm the one that sent you. Then I find out he was the colonel of 3rd Division where I was stationed. All this time, he knew where I was. And I didn't know who in the hell this guy was. You know, he came, he talked to me, he said, you did a hell of a job. He gave me my two rings, which was military, and the Masonic, which I'm a Freemason. And the red means blood, and the rest of these means war and sacrifice and everything. And that's what he gave me. That was in 73. I'm an honorary Freemason with the Masonic temple, which I didn't know what it was. And I told him I couldn't wear it until 217 because it had to be 45 years. Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah. But it just, you know, and things are coming back. And, you know, I still have nightmares. But the VA, like I said, these guys are fabulous. These guys have been on my back. They got me at 100%. They're taking good care of me. Damn good care of me. And I, you know, after 45 years, they called me and said, I got rid of this. I don't want to talk about it anymore. Just go away. Colonel called me on my phone. He says, you better get your butt down here. I said, yes, sir. That was it. And I went down and checked in. And the guy in Napa, Dell set me up, and the rest is history. It's been 2 years now, and they have been literally taking care of me. I mean, 100%.
That's great.
And I love these guys. Yeah. You know,
that's wonderful, so, Nick.
Any of the soldiers that are watching this, get your butt to the VA because they take care of you. Don't sit there and cry. Just go do it.
Just go do it. I love that. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
Perhaps hitching onto the back of that, would you feel comfortable at all talking about some of your, what should we call it, perhaps post-war trauma?
I don't care. And, you know, this, again, I have a good counselor. JT is an Afghanistan soldier and veteran, and he knows. And we hit the same spot. But some of the stuff I've told him, he goes, holy crap, I didn't realize that. I said, hello. It's a different war, buddy. You're above ground. We're underground. You know, like my son was in Afghanistan. I learned from my son, you know. So, but, yeah, I mean, the VA, like I said, I had problems before. I wouldn't talk. They start talking. I said, goodbye. I got to go. I don't want to talk about it. I just walk off and leave. The only one I talk to is my dad, because he did the same thing I did, but a different war. And we both came into the same freaking thing. It's either you or them. I had a job to do. I did it. I came home. That's what it was about. Like my dad said, I had a job to do, and that was it. You know, but I still have my nightmares. I'll wake up speaking Vietnamese. And before my wife passed away in 2020, she said, I keep hearing this thing called Di Di Mao. What does that mean? That means get the hell out of there. I'm going to kill you. Oh, I won't ask you no more. So, you know, I said, okay, thank you. And then I'd say, Buku Diki Dao. What was that? And I said, that means you're crazy. You don't get out of my way. I'm going to take you out. That's what I would tell when I caught some of these guys. I'd say, Buku Diki Dao. They'd say, you know, I'm going to kill you. You don't get out of the way. Yeah. I mean, that's some of that stuff is still cut. Even though they're working with me, it's never going to go away.
Right.
It's going to be a little easier, but it's them, because they've got me at 90% of PTSD with the VA. And I didn't even ask for that. They sent me into a, I guess you call it a psychologist or whatever, that counselor that finds out your rating, you know. And she says right away, this is done. I can tell you right now what's wrong, because she's done so many of us, especially from Vietnam. You know, a lot of them are from Vietnam. And I still talk, but not a lot. And certain people I will talk to that I trust, like my new girlfriend, I tell her everything she wants to know. And she's kind of got me good right now. She's got me to where, you know, you're good, you're fine. Boom. You know, and she knows, which is a great thing.
Yeah.
And the family, my kids, and my son, we talked a lot. Three of us did, my dad and him. And I, like I said, I have so much stuff on Patton that people would not even believe what he did. It's not even in the books. It'll never be in the books because they hid it. You know, without Patton, we wouldn't have won the war.
Right.
I'm serious. Yeah. But talking about what I did, I mean, like I said, when I go to a restaurant, I got to have a wall behind me. I want to see who's in front of me. You know, I got to see what's in front of me. And don't, like, I mean, I can hear. I lost a lot of my hearing, too. I forgot my hearing aids today. Holy cow. Hello. But, I mean, there's certain things I see. I'll see way ahead of you before you see what's in front of you. That's the way I was taught. I can see what's coming before you even see it.
Yeah.
You know, and behind, I can feel people walking behind me, you know.
I understand that.
That's just the idea, you know.
Yeah. Well, I remember I interviewed a veteran a while back who told me that when he's driving on the highway, you know, sometimes trucks or whatever will pull, you know, in front of, behind, and to the side of you, and you'll feel kind of boxed in. He says he starts to, I guess, have an episode, might be the best way of phrasing it, when he feels enclosed and doesn't see an immediate exit.
You're confined. You can't move. You can't get out of the situation you're in. I'm the same way. I'll just pull over and go the other way. You know, I don't do road rage, but I'm very, and I have protective instinct, very much so protective. You touch my family, you better start praying, because I'm going to come looking for you and I'll find you. You know, I'm just saying, that's the way I am. And, you know, in any family or friends, but I'm that way in traffic. That's why I stay back. I stay at the sides. I can read. I can just see things. It's hard to explain, but I can see things coming and I avoid it, you know, because I mean, it's just, I mean, you got a lot of knuckleheads out there that think they know everything in the world, but don't know nothing until they run into somebody like us. It's like, oh crap, we just pushed the wrong button. I said, yeah, Merry Christmas.
Wrong day, wrong person.
That's right. And I mean, I one time, and I still feel bad about this. I was running my family's restaurant. They had a real high-end restaurant up here in Northern California. And I ran it for them. And I took the evenings because I like the evenings. I like to be, you know, and I closed. And the bartender was, it was a real classy place. And the bartender and I would close every night. So one day he didn't know I was in the military. We didn't talk. So we closed up, locked up. He went into the men's room and he used the room, and I clock up and I went in the back to lock up, and I was going to use the bathroom. He knew I was coming. He turned the light up, opened the door. He scared me. I broke his nose. I just broke his nose. And he sat back. He thought, oh my, I almost knocked him out. Wow. And he said, oh my God. I said, well, don't do that to me. And I felt bad. So I got him on workman's comp and everything. So him and he, I told him he fell and hit his nose on the door, you know, so, so the owners wouldn't say, oh crap, but he became a good friend. Vince became a good friend and he knew, he goes, Nick, he'd yell, Nick, can I come back now? I tell him he's smart.
That's funny.
But, I mean, it's, I don't have fear. I see things before, it's hard to explain. I can see things before they happen. I have a gut feeling. I just walk around and just go away. You know, I walk away from it. And even my grandkids, my kids were young. They had to take a stick to wake dad up because I come up and grab him. One of my sons was younger and he jolted me. And I grabbed him like it was like I was grabbing I was grabbing him. He goes, oh, dad, it's me. Oh, I'm sorry. Let him go. You know, and it took me a while for my wife when we got married, but she knew what to do and what not to do. And it just became, I knew she was there. I was relaxed. I didn't care. You know, so I mean, it's the PTSD, what they call it now. Then yeah. It was shell shock and everything else.
Right.
But yeah, I still have it. Yes. But I've got it. I mean, I've got it to where I'm calm. My new girlfriend, she's just my mood has changed with her.
Completely. That's great.
You know, and that's basically where it's at. But I mean, there's certain things that I mean, I'll talk real nice. But if you keep going on a subject and you don't know what you're talking about, oh, I've been here, I've done Vietnam. I've been there, buddy. So you're not going to, you know, and I've met a lot of those guys. And these veterans that were just a cook. I mean, everybody in the Army, we needed those guys. I don't care if you're a cook. I don't care if you're a typist. I don't care what you are. Without there, we couldn't do our job in Vietnam. We couldn't do our job in Afghanistan, in Germany. Without those guys, we're all one. I don't give a damn what you did. I don't give a damn what the hell you did. So we put our on the line. But without you, our would be gone on that line.
Right.
We'd be dead. Okay, so we needed everybody in the military, to me, are all equal. There's nobody better than anybody else. In fact, I didn't even take my badges because when the colonel said, I'll talk to you when you're 45 years old, but he passed away. But I said, I don't want my badges. I don't want any of that freaking stuff. No, because he said I had two Purple Hearts. I don't want that because I did it for the guys there, not for awards. I don't want that stuff. Give it to somebody that wants it. My dad was the same way. My dad got five bronze stars, two silvers. Yeah, I mean, he had like 20 some odd badges. He came home, he gave it to his nephews. I don't want them because I didn't do it for that. Say,
wow.
And that's just the way we are. You know, yeah. I don't care. It's just a badge. But what I had to do for that, I don't think you want to know.
Yeah.
I don't want to forget that, you know.
Yeah. No, I understand that, Nick. Well, I'd love to move a little bit from Vietnam, Nick, then to your movie career. And I think okay. I'd like to ask you, I'm really keen to know, what was it like being a stuntman for Francis Coppola Productions?
For Coppola? Piece of cake. Yeah. I love that guy. His nephew was one of our producers, Christopher, which was Nicolas Cage's brother. Mm-hmm. And I worked with Nicolas. Nicolas was a sweetheart. That guy's a sweetheart. What a great guy. Oh, my God. What a knucklehead. He's another one. but, I mean, working in the movie business was great. When I went on Falcon Crest, because I helped the guy that came up looking for locations, you know, and I started the show. It was about 3 weeks into my first year working on Falcon Crest. We were up at a ranch doing a horse thing. And Susan Sullivan, which is a sweetheart, and I love that lady, was one of the actors on the show. And she said, hey, you. She didn't know. She thought I was a P. Hey, you, come here. I need this. Just get over and do this. And I walked in and I said, my name is not hey, you. My name is Nick. Show me respect and I'll do anything in the world you want. If not, get out of my way. And all the guys around me go, oh, well, Nick's fired. He's gone. Goodbye. Producer came up to him and said, wait and hear somebody say that. But she became a good friend. And I love that lady. I mean, everybody on Falcon Crest and Jane Wyman was really good to me. Cesar Romero became a good buddy, a real good friend. We'd have dinner all the time after the show. I mean, all of them did. Lorenzo Lamas was great. But Jane, she was the mama on the set. She would always call me her little Nikki. I was her little Nikki. Yeah. So the guys knew, don't mess with Nick. But then after that, then I started stunts. I always wanted to do stunts. So I did stuff for Paramount. And I did three films for Coppola. And I mean, I came off buildings as high as 60 feet. I came off a building 60 feet on fire. I mean, I had no fear at all. And I loved it. Jumping off the buildings, that was the greatest feeling in the world, you know. And then I did one called The Clown House. I was dressed up and I weighed about 145, but that uniform was 200 pounds. So I had to come out a window and make that bag, you know. So it was a lot of work. And it was a 40-foot drop. But being a stuntman was great. Fighting, I mean, I rode cars. I have no fear. I thought it was fun. And it was great. My wife says, you're crazy. She said, I don't want to watch what you do. You know, you're crazy. But when I came off the building, we had a show up. We did up in Napa. And I came off. It was close to 60 feet on fire. And my daughter was there, and the assistant director, Ricker, was up on top. I said, I don't want to see any family in front of me because I don't want to be distracted. I came off that, you know, 60 feet on fire. I got pushed off. It was like an explosion. I came off, went on 60 feet into a bag. And when I hit the bag deflated wrong. I landed right. I didn't get hurt. And the guys, I mean, that scared the hell out of everybody. Y'all come out trying to find me. And I really come out to hold the back ways. I was sitting there and behind him, you guys looking for me? And I was like, where the hell did you go? But no, being in there. And then I was also an assistant director. I was a location manager and a production manager. I did stuff for Paramount, CBS, NBC, ABC, a lot of the shows that I did. Basic Instinct was one of my best shows I worked with Mike. That was a great show. And I mean, I did a lot of them and different movie of the weeks, well over 60 commercials I did as a production manager. And I did stunts and I did, you know, I did a lot of other stuff for them. But the Hollywood, you know, I guess that was my call because my grandfather, my adopted grandfather, he worked with Walt Disney. He gave Walt Disney his first job at Hal Roach Studios as a prop boy. And he told me by the time you're 30, you're going to be working for Disney. 30 years old, I was working for Disney.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, he designed a lot. You remember the Buster Brown shoes?
Yes.
You remember that little boy that's on it? That's
sure.
My grandfather.
Huh.
That's my grandpa. My adopted grandpa.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. He'd always take that finger, always had that finger. And he said, but you're going to learn. I'm going to teach you and you're going to do it. I said, okay, okay. You got it. But he's the one that really got me in. But after I was in football, the movie business left my head. But when I saw what it was, I'm thinking, oh, you got me, baby. Let's do it. Goodbye. So I said goodbye to the semi-pro leagues. I'm gone.
Wow. That's incredible.
But the business, it did a lot for me. And as investigating journalist for ABC, Good Morning America, World News. ABC was my main show. I did the Oscars. Did it for 3 years. That was fun. But I don't deal with attitudes and egos, you know. And that's, I said, after that, I said, I had to keep my mouth shut because some of these guys, I said, get the hell out of my camera. Give me a guy that knows what he's talking about. But, you know, it's just the way it was. And we did a lot of interviews and I did a lot of, I mean, I was back there at 9/11. I found stuff you would not believe that happened back there, you know, and Barbara, that's when I worked, did stuff for Barbara Walters. And again, that lady, like I said, was a sweetheart, knew her business big time. But she was a sweetheart, and I would do anything in the world for that lady.
Yeah, you know, Nicholas, maybe we can talk about her for just a minute, because as you point out, she did just recently pass. And yeah, if you wouldn't mind maybe going into some detail, what was it like working for her? How long did you do it, and how would you describe her?
Well, she's a very strong woman, and she knows what she wants. Trust me, that lady knew exactly, and you better do it. Because and that's why she was great at what she did. She was one of the best in the business. She started it for the women. It wasn't for her. They wouldn't be where they are now. Barbara right. Walters started all that. She was the honcho of the whole thing. And we would be on the phone talking about a 9/11 or talking about things that we did up in the valley. And I did a show on Julia Roberts, Dying Young, was Dying Young. And she wanted me to, so I set up interviews and everything and did everything for her. And she just came across me. She goes, she called me Nikki. She goes, Nikki, I like you. Would you work for me? I said, well, I'm contracted to Good Morning America. She says, well, I can change that with her hands. I can change that. I said, no, I like what I'm doing because I get to investigate every story that I want to investigate. But I'll work for you anytime you want. So I did 3 shows for her. And she was a doll. I mean, she taught me the business in many ways. One thing was respect. Do your job and get it done well, and you'll always be called. I did my job, did it well. I was always called. I was either New York, LA. I was in San Diego. I was in Texas, Denver. I was overseas. I went where they sent me because of my military background. I did a lot with the military. But in our business, in that kind of business, it's a lot of guys, it's a huge industry, the biggest one, but it's a small town of just 6,000 people maybe working. And we're the ones who create what we're seeing now. Without us, we wouldn't be doing this. Okay. And I love the business. But like I said, I had to quit in 2013 because my wife meant more to me when she was sick with the metastatic cancer, and that meant more. And then she passed away in 2020, but they kept asking me to come back. And I just said, you know, I like what I'm doing now. The VA's taking care of me. I'm writing my book now. And my partner that worked at Paramount, and she has her own business, which she is my agent, but she's tops down there. She's one of the top ones. And she's now waiting for me to do my book, and she's getting it out to there's 3 people I get from my understanding that want it. So I told her on my time. She says, you take as long as you want. So, but that's where I am. But if certain people call me, like if Coppola called me, yes, I'd work for him anytime in a heartbeat. I don't care what it is. And if the guys at Disney called me, at Disney Studios where I worked, I said, yep, whatever you want. Anybody else? Yeah.
No. Sure. Wonderful, Nick.
But it was a good life. And I'm still living it. I'm 70 years old, and to get out of my way, I got things to do. You know, I don't stop.
That's excellent. My last question for you, sir. How do you want to be remembered?
As a good guy, Napa Nick. Yeah, I'm just as a good guy. I'll do anything for anybody. Just don't lie to me. Don't BS me. I'll do anything in the world for you. And in the military, that's history. Okay, That's history. Movie business, sure, I don't care. Yeah, that's where I got my name, Napa Nick, because they couldn't spell my name. Yeah, but that's what it is. I mean, I did my job. And after 45 years, the guys at the VA started making me talk. And a lot of guys knows, I didn't know you did all that. My dad bought me a Vietnam hat in 212. I said, Pop, you know, I can't wear that until 217. So he says, I got it for now. But when you get it, you're going to wear it. 217, he knocked at my front door at my house. He says, put that hat on. I want to see you wearing it from now on. You will wear it from now on. And I made him the promise. That's why I still wear it. I go into restaurants. Well, take your hat off. I said, you touch my hat. You don't want to do that. I said, I'm wearing this for my dad. Goodbye. But when it comes to the flag, my hat comes off. Or we salute, I keep it on. But anywhere else, nah. That's for my dad. That's what some of these badges are here for. You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. And like I said, that was the war, like I said, to end all wars. That was the worst war there was. Vietnam was a little bit of Germany. And we were the biggest war after Germany. The biggest one. You know, we lost a lot of guys. About 17 years? My God.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And we could have taken them guys out in no time. It was just a political war. I don't want to get into politics, but that's just basically, that's what we all thought. I mean, you ask any veteran, he'll tell you that. Yeah. I'm not, you know, I'd stay away from politics. I don't like it.
Well, Nick, this was a pleasure, sir. I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time for me.
Hey, no problem. I mean, you know, you're like my counselor at the VA. You got it out of me. You're one of the few that got it out of me. I'll tell you right now.
Okay. I appreciate that, man. I'll take it as a compliment. I take it kindly.
You better. Because I know where you're at.
You got my number and you got my email. That'll be enough.
I got your number, boy. Yeah.
Nick, thank you so much again for taking the time for me. I appreciate everything and I will let you go.
Thanks, buddy. Take care and have a good week. All right, buddy.
Bye.
See you later.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.